has any other comments. Thank you again, Heather.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, we're moving now down to number 7. It's Joe Pinesco and his group, Office of the Attorney General. We're going into training now for a period of time.
All right. Thank you, Chair and Commissioners. Again, Joe Pinesco, I'm the Section Chief for the Fish Wildlife Parks Section within the Public Lands and Conservation Division of the Attorney General's Office. We are giving legal training here, and I am joined by two of my colleagues, Amy Dona and Lauren Kerrigan. We're going to be splitting up the presentation. I'll be taking the first little bit, turning it over to Lauren, turning it over, then I'll be doing a little bit more, turning it over to Amy, and then I'll wrap up. Got a few topics here, so you know we're trying to get this under 90 minutes, but we'll see how it goes. And then we do have an executive session after that. So this portion is open to the public. All the information we're sharing is general information. We welcome questions, but if questions start getting into the range of, you know, legal advice type questions, we may well say, well, that's more of a legal advice issue that we shouldn't be taking up in front of the public and take offline.
Joe, if I may, yes. do you want to take questions during the presentation or at the end? What was your pleasure?
From a time perspective, it's safer to take them at the end. If people are willing to have just a broader dialogue to the extent we need to on any of these topics, I don't mind taking questions during the presentation for my portion.
Okay, we'll try and keep them more towards the end if possible, I think. Thank you.
All right, let me turn off my email and then get into my sharing the screen. Okay, so people should be looking at the slides in the proper view. Does that look good? Any confirmation from anyone?
Yes, looks good.
Right, thank you. Okay, so we're going to be talking. We'll be talking about the legal environment in which the Fish and Wildlife Commission operates. And one of the reasons for doing this legal training is the fact that we do have two new commissioners with us today. And to try to help better familiarize them with the legal issues that confront the commission. And that's it. So I'm going to keep going. So names and a few details about our practice areas of myself, Amy, and Lauren. So the role of the Attorney General's office. So the Attorney General's office is a constitutionally created state office. The Attorney General is one of the 9 statewide elected officials. And in the Constitution, it states that the Attorney General is to be the advisor to the state officers and agencies. And there is a little bit more language about that role set out in RCW 4310.040. Within the Attorney General's office, we have 30 divisions, I think, right now. It changes over, not infrequently, surprisingly. So our current division is a newly merged division. It's called the Public Lands and Conservation Division. Patricia O'Brien is our division chief. She goes by Patty informally. And actually, I'll be having Patty come and introduce herself to the commission at one of our future meetings just for a quick little 3-minute greet. Within the Public Lands and Conservation Division, there are 3 sections. The division advises the Department of Natural Resources, Department of Fish and Wildlife, as well as state parks. So I'm the section chief for the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks section. Including myself, we have 9 attorneys in our section, and our section does fish and wildlife and state parks. The other 2 sections do DNR work. Our section does not handle for fish and wildlife labor and personnel matters, which include human resources, discipline, collective bargaining, other union issues, or tort lawsuits, personal injury cases against Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. Our office, because both of those are more specialized areas of law, we have a torts division and we have a labor and personnel division. So there are specifically assigned attorneys who handle those issues for the department. And they will brief us about what's going on those topics on a quarterly basis. We don't normally track their matters closely. We do handle all other aspects of Fish and Wildlife legal services. We do affirmative litigation, defensive litigation, client advice. And besides the general statutory obligation of the Attorney General to represent all state agencies, there are some statutes within Title 77, Fish and Wildlife statutes, that expressly reference the role of the Attorney General. In 7715065, it points out that if a county prosecutor who's the normal jurisdiction to bring a criminal charge for a fish or wildlife crime, if a county prosecutor decides not to file charges on a fish and wildlife case, the Attorney General's office can step in and fill that role. We don't have a team of prosecutors on hand within our division dedicated to that. So that happens very infrequently. The AG's office has a specifically mentioned role with regards to the purchase or sale of property by the department. The AG's office, again, is mentioned with respect to imposing or recovering hydraulic project penalties for HPA violations in that statute. One of the interesting questions as a public lawyer working for the Attorney General's office is who is the client? In private practice, you are paid by your client. You have an ethical duty to zealously represent your client, and your client is very well defined. As a public attorney, we work for the Attorney General, who's a statewide officer who provides legal advice to all entities at the state agency level. We're assigned to specific agencies, and the specific agency is our client, but we are also asked by the Attorney General, and this is every Attorney General who I've worked for over the last 21 years in the office, we're asked to keep an eye out for the broader public interest, as well as just our client agency's specific requests. If an agency asks us, hey, what about this? One of the things, if we're doing our job, we'll say, well, okay, so here's the answer for you on this topic, but you may want to think about that legal position that could adversely impact other state agencies as well. Do you really want to do that? You may want to talk to those other state agencies. So we have the ability to think a little bit more broadly on that aspect. A real critical aspect of our legal services to you, we give you options-based legal advice. We work for a separately elected independent state official. We don't work for, you know, we're not an employee of the Fish and Wildlife Agency. Our role is to advise the department. The department makes all decisions about the department's business. So it will be very rare where you will have one of your attorneys telling someone within the Fish and Wildlife or the commission, you must do this or you must do that, unless it's something that is an explicit statutorily mandated duty. Everything else is legal options. You may ask us, can we do this? Is it legal? And we may look at it and we will say, well, under the statute, you probably can. The statute's not expressly clear on this topic, but there's room to argue it. But there could be risks. There could be an interpretation of the statute that you can't do that. And if you do it anyhow and someone sues, what would the risks be? What would the adverse ramifications be if someone sued and you lost in court? We lay out, our role is to lay out all of that analysis, give you the legal input, give you the risk analysis, but ultimately the department should make the policy decision. There's many questions about agency authority, and this arises across all agencies, where the statutes are not exactly clear and you have room to make a decision. And so we will advise you, you pick the decision. And then our role is to defend that. If someone challenges it in court, we will defend it to the best of our ability. But and almost all the time, any decision should be Fish and Wildlife's decision. So if we give you legal advice, it really makes me cringe to hear a staff person or a commissioner say, the AG's office told us to do this, right? Because we're not telling you to do that. We're giving you advice and then you make the decision. So we really want the department to take ownership in the decision. After getting legal advice and risk-based analysis, the department should own the decision, and it should be the department's decision that is announced to the public. And there's also a risk if you start saying our attorneys told us this, then you're potentially waiving attorney-client privilege, and someone outside of our attorney-client relationship could start inquiring further and saying, well, hey, you're sharing your attorney-client advice, so you need to tell us more of it. And we really want to watch out for that. So that's the role of our office. And by the way, because I am in slide mode, if anyone is raising their hand, Nikki, if you could call that out, I'd be happy to take questions on that. So that's covering the role of the Attorney General's office. Just really quickly, I actually started doing more research on this. I've been advising Fish and Wildlife for 11 years now, and I still do not have mapped out in my head the whole history of fish and game management in the state. I haven't had to research very deeply, but just here's a few tidbits of interest for you. So prior to 1921, from what I can tell, and I haven't exhaustively researched this, Fisheries management was handled separately from game management. There was not a single statewide entity that managed both. And more on the game side, there appears to have been a lot more heavy county involvement in game management prior to 1921. In 1921, the legislature passed, they called it the Administrative Code, but what it was a code regarding the administration of state government. It created 10 state departments. One of those departments was actually a combined Department of Fisheries and Game. That lasted for 11 years because there was a People's Initiative, Initiative Measure 62 in 1932, that passed 53-47%, and it separated the agencies. It made them separate agencies, Department of Fisheries headed by a director appointed by the governor that managed food fish, and there was a separate Department of Game. The director was still appointed by the governor. It did have a game commission that had some similarities to the current commission structure, but the director was still hired by the governor. And its oversight was all wildlife, including almost all living things, including game fish. And the exception was food fish, which was segregated for the Department of Fisheries Management. 1947, from what I can tell, is the game code was updated, and it preserved the commission structure. And that appears to be the first time that the commission started hiring the director of game. In 1987, the legislature decided to change things up. They renamed it from the Department of Game to the Department of Wildlife, and they said that the director was going to be hired by the governor instead of by the commission. And I believe Kurt Smitsch was the person who served in that role, and he was the only person who served in that role because just 6 years later, the legislature decided to merge the agencies, and it directed the departments to merge. The merger actually took effect in 1994. Under that model, the new director of Fish and Wildlife was to be hired by the governor. But there was still a commission in play. And then the People's Initiative or People's Referendum 45 in 1995, they went to the current commission form. So the current laws that you operate under as a commission of the department, that has been in place just since 1995. So you can see there's been a lot of history and a lot of change over history. And there's even more prior to 1921 that I haven't tracked. So the structure has not been something of extreme longevity and consistency. There's been just differences over time. The department structure by statute, RCW 7704020, points out that the department, as it's the full legal entity, consists of the State Fish and Wildlife Commission and the director. And the commission may delegate to the director any of the powers and duties vested in the commission. So we have the department, which is the large umbrella, and under that umbrella, we have the commission and we have the director. And then on top of that, the commission hires the director and oversees the director. And then the director essentially oversees the rest of the department, guided by policies set by the commission. In Title 77, there are some rulemaking authority statutes that specifically say the commission shall do these rules. And general language about the commission shall do rulemaking. However, in the title, you will find other statutes that specify that the director can do some rules or just the department generically can do rules, in which case you could pick the director or the commission. And also the commission has delegated some of its rulemaking authority to the director. There is a delegation order on the books that the commission has authorized. In terms of the scope of your statutes and rules, historically, when there were two agencies, Title 75 of the Revised Code of Washington was the Fisheries Code, and Title 77 was the Game Code. And then under the rules, under the WAC, Title 220 was the Fisheries Rules, and Title 232 were the Game Rules. Now, the merger of the statutes, they all merged everything to Title 77, formerly just the Game Code. So all the fisheries issues were moved into Title 77. Interestingly, that happened in 2000, 6 years after the merger took place. So things were sort of messy on a statutory perspective because the merger took time to implement. And even worse than that, the two titles in the Washington Administrative Code between game and fisheries, they weren't merged until 2017. Now, the department and the commission did pay attention to the merger in their subsequent rulemaking after 1994, but they still resided in two different places in the WAC. And those were finally merged in 220. Also, there is a small handful of statutes hiding in RCW 4330 or 43300. It is a small chapter. I can't remember, it's like five or seven statutes. And those are original statutes from the 1993 merger bill that directed the department to merge. And they also parallel statutes in Title 77 regarding the structure of the department. You will still see in the statutes vestiges of the separate agencies. For example, the distinction between food fish and game fish. And there's a number of other statutes that have some things lingering between game and fisheries management. So regarding the scope of general law on state agency authority, agencies carry out the authority expressly granted in statute and any additional authority necessarily implied by the expressly granting statutes. Agencies can engage in rulemaking when authorized by statute, and the rules can further clarify or fill in the gaps of RCWs. The rules cannot contradict RCWs, and rules carry the force of law once they're properly enacted. So that's my brief overview of the legal structure. So we have some procedural laws that we're going to talk about, and this is where I'm going to kick things over. We're going to talk about the Public Records Act. That'll be Lauren. Open Publics Meeting Act will be me. Administrative Procedure Act, State Environmental Policy Act, and Regulatory Fairness Act will be Amy. And then I'll come back and touch on ethics and public service. So any questions yet before
Vice Chair Baker has a question, Joe?
Yes. You're still muted.
Thank you, Joe. Oh, sorry. I don't trust the camera on my computer. Really nice presentation. I always think I know this stuff and I always learn something. I have a question. You said that in some sort of an extreme case, the AG could step in as a prosecutor if there's a prosecutor that is for some reason unwilling to serve. Does that change venue? Does that give us concurrent jurisdiction in either the county where the action occurred and Olympia, or are we still required to do the prosecution in the county where the action occurred?
Yeah, it would not change venue. So we would need to abide by the standard venue rules. And typically with a criminal context, it would be a county in which at least some portion of the criminal conduct occurred.
Okay, thank you.
So if that is everything on that, I'm going to pass it off to Lauren. And Nikki, you're going to bring up her presentation, correct? Nikki. I could also bring it up.
And I can screen share it too. I think I can figure out how to do that.
I can do it. Just give me 1 second. I didn't have your PowerPoint open, but I can open it in 60 seconds. And I did save it to my desktop, so I'm not reliant on the network connection for it. All right. Get the right one. PRA. Share. Okay, does that look good?
It does. So do I just tell you when to change or can I do it?
Okay. Yeah, I have to do it.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. Thanks so much for having me. I'm going to try to make this Public Records Act presentation engaging. I'm excited to be here. So before I start, I just want to read some quotes from the actual Public Records Act, because I think it's important to know the lens through which superior courts are interpreting that law. So I'm going to read a few quotes. The first is, the people do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. It also says that the people in delegating authority do not give public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good for them to know. And finally, it says that the people insist on remaining informed so that they may retain control over the instruments that they have created. And I'm quoting these quotes to you from the PRA because when we look at case law published by appellate courts, we see these quotes in virtually every decision that the courts publish. So these quotes is really frames the purpose of the Public Records Act and is really, really important to courts when they're interpreting the act and whether or not agencies have complied with the act. Joe, could you please change the slide? Maybe I'll come up with one word to signal. Okay. So the broad mandate, so the Public Records Act is 4256. And it generally requires that agencies make any public record available for public inspection and copying upon request, unless a specific exemption implies. And the major takeaway for this bullet is to remember that disclosure is broadly construed, exemptions are narrowly construed. So when courts are looking at whether or not information that's otherwise public is exempt under the PRA, they're going to be looking at the specific words of that exemption and whether the specific information that the agency has applied complies with the plain language of that exemption. Exemptions are listed in the Public Records Act, but other statutes may also exempt records from public disclosure. And I put 1350 as an example because I used to be an AAG for Department of Social and Health Services. And under 1350, child welfare records cannot be disclosed through the Public Records Act. There are other statutes that are similar to that one. Change slide, please. Thanks. So the PRA mandates disclosure of public records. And there's been some argument before courts about what this means. And it means a writing containing information relating to the conduct of government or the performance of any governmental or proprietary function that is prepared, owned, used, or retained by any state or local agency, regardless of physical form or characteristics. So essentially, any record that the agency uses or keeps or creates for agency business is a public record. And what do we mean by writing? Change slide, please. Thank you. Well, writing is specifically defined in statute. However, its meaning has been litigated over pretty extensively because the Public Records Act was passed by initiative in the 1970s. And the definition of writing hasn't changed since the 1970s. So there are some things that are contained in this definition that are no longer used. And there are also writings that have been declared as writings under the PRA that were not in existence in the 1970s. Examples are text messages, email correspondence, video recordings, screenshots. That you take when, for people who have smartphones, you can screenshot things. That can become a writing. Also chats, like Teams chats, for example, can be considered writings under the PRA. And if those writings are created, used, or owned by agencies, then they're public records under the PRA, and they're subject to public disclosure. Slide, please. So in submitting a request to trigger the process under the PRA, a requester need not submit a particular form, even though agencies may request that they do so. WDFW has a form, for example, that they ask requesters to fill out for public records requests. But under the statute, you could be in a meeting with someone and they could request public records, and that could be construed as a public records request under 4256. Requests can be made to anyone within WDFW. They often accompany other lawsuits. We've seen them in conjunction with civil forfeiture cases, but also cases brought under torts, under the Open Public Meetings Act, for example. We can see PRA cases associated with those. The requests have to seek identifiable records. What that means is that there has to be enough of a description in the request for a reasonable person to have an idea of what the requester is seeking. That means that requesters cannot seek all records of an agency, but they can request all records of an agency related to a particular topic. And that topic can be very broad. And when an agency receives a request like that, which is broad, it cannot deny the request because the request is broad or it's vague. They can seek clarification. And if they don't ultimately get enough clarification to have an idea of what the requester is seeking, they might be able to deny the request, but they can also come up with an agency interpretation to send to the requester, putting the requester on notice how they're interpreting the request. And that has been done for requests received by WDFW in the past. Slide, please. So when an agency receives a public records request triggering the process under 4256, it has to respond within 5 days, 5 business days. And in responding to that request, it has to either produce the records, seek clarification, deny the request, or let the requester know that the agency needs more time, either because the request is broad or the agency is going to have to search in multiple locations for responsive records. But at the end of the day, agencies have to conduct searches that are reasonably calculated to locate responsive records. This means that they have to employ effective means for locating records through search tools, like Discovery Accelerator, for example, and they have to search all places where responsive records are reasonably likely to be located. And this includes basically any forum that an agency employee might use to store records. That would include the H drive, the S drive, the cloud storage devices, external hard drives, personal computers, and mobile phones are also places where responsive records might be maintained. And it's the agency that's responsible for trying to locate and provide responsive records, even if those records aren't in the agency's physical possession. Slide, please. Potentially responsive records have to be preserved or placed on hold while the agency's response to the request is pending. So even, for example, if a record is transitory, if it might be responsive to a pending public records request, the agency has to hold on to it. It can't get rid of that record. Responsive records must be gathered and produced, but have to be produced in installments. So an agency doesn't have to gather up an entire universe of records and produce them at one time. It can process the records and produce them over time. Production need not happen within a specified time, but the time frame has to be reasonable. And who determines reasonableness? Well, essentially the superior courts do, because that is who's going to be looking at the agency's response when they're determining whether or not the agency has complied with the Public Records Act. Agencies may charge fees, but they can only charge fees for things like copying and for production of USBs and the acts as floppy disks because it's an old act, but it can't charge fees for staff time, for example, in searching for responsive records. Slide, please. Thank you. So I mentioned that agencies are responsible for locating and producing records not in their physical possession. This is a somewhat new development that came out as a result of a Washington State Supreme Court case in 2015. And you may have heard of it. It was pretty famous at the time, but it involved former elected prosecutor Mark Lindquist and text messages that he had on his personal cell phone device. The Pierce County Prosecutor's Office received a request for records. Former prosecutor Lindquist had responsive text messages on his phone, but he did not produce them. And so after much litigation concerning that, the Supreme Court finally came down and said, well, if there are records that an agency employee prepares, owns, uses, or retains on their personal cell phone that they are maintaining within the scope of their employment, then those text messages are public records. So the same logic would apply to other records, like email correspondence, for example, or working documents saved on a personal computer, presentations saved on a personal computer. And so the agency has an obligation to make sure that they've checked with the employees to make sure the employees have searched their personal devices and provided responsive records. Slide, please. So I mentioned that the general rule is that agencies must make any public record available for inspection and copying unless an exemption applies. And I also mentioned that disclosure is broad while exemptions are construed narrowly. So this is sort of along the same vein. If an exemption applies, that doesn't necessarily justify withholding the record in their entirety. So agencies are allowed to apply exemptions to information contained in records, redact what they need to, and then disclose the remainder that doesn't fall within the scope of those exemptions. Agencies, if they do apply exemptions, they're required to provide exemption logs to requesters citing the basis for the information that has been withheld, whether it's information contained in the record or withholding the record in their in its entirety. Slide, please. So a lot of the, well, most of the PRA exemptions are within the context of RCW 4256. And it might surprise some people, it surprised me, to know that there's not a privacy exemption. Some of the exemptions in the PRA incorporate privacy as an element. For example, personal information in agency employee files are exempt under a specific subsection of the PRA to the extent that release would violate the employee's right to privacy. And the violation of a right to privacy has been analyzed by courts. And what they have held is that a violation of a person's right to privacy only occurs when disclosure would both be highly offensive to a reasonable person and is not of a legitimate concern to the public. So depending on what the information is, who it pertains to, and the context surrounding that information, what we have found essentially is that meeting this burden is a pretty high bar. It has to be pretty private information, and the context has to be such where there's no legitimate right to that information. Slide, please. Other exemptions that the WDFW has applied are attorney-client privilege, which we will talk about, and that is in RCW 560060, so that is not a PRA exemption in the four corners of that statute. The investigative records exemption applies to enforcement program open investigation records because they are considered to be a law enforcement agency. Personal information, including financial account numbers, social security numbers, names, addresses, and phone numbers are also expressly exempt. And the Washington State Supreme Court has recently ruled that dates of birth do not fall in this category. And so those are disclosable to the public. And certain WDFW records are expressly exempt under 4256-430. And that exemption applies to basically a wide variety of things, but it's mostly sensitive fish and wildlife data. So commercial fish and catch data, tribal fish and shellfish data, certain information regarding damage prevention cooperative agreements and non-lethal preventative measures are also exempt under the PRA. Not categorically, but certain information related to those things are exempt under the PRA. Slide, please. So there are financial consequences associated with not strictly complying with PRA mandates. An agency might violate the PRA by failing to timely respond to a request. So that might mean failing to respond within the requisite 5 days. That might mean failing to provide estimates of installments or times when they're going to be providing installments of records, or just failing to timely respond overall with reasonable diligence and thoroughness. And again, what constitutes reasonable diligence and thoroughness? It's really analyzed through the eyes of the court, looking at the facts surrounding the request, the other requests that the agency is responding to, in other words, their workload, what else they have going on, and what communications have taken place between the agency and the requester. The agency might violate the PRA by failing to adequately search or improperly withholding. And when I say improperly withholding, I don't mean intentionally withholding a document that the agency believes to be disclosable. What I mean is improper withholding might happen if an agency misses a document during their search that the court deems should have been found through that search, or even in good faith, analyzing an exemption and applying it to a record and the Supreme Court disagreeing with their analysis of the exemption and application. So that's what I mean by improper withholding. If any of those things happen and a requester is dissatisfied with the agency's response, the remedy for that requester is to file a lawsuit in Superior Court. the Superior Court will review the agency's response. If it finds that an agency has improperly withheld a document, it can assess financial penalties. And those penalties are assessed on a per record and can be assessed on a per day basis, per page, per day basis, starting at $0 and going up to $100, depending on several mitigating and aggravating factors. So basically, courts will look at, again, the communication between the agency and the requester, the training that the agency has provided, the robustness of the agency's policies and practices in processing PRA requests, and the existence of bad faith is also something that the court looks at. But it really looks at the totality of the circumstances when it's presented with the case and deciding how much penalties to award. But penalties can be assessed for as little as a few hundred dollars to as much as several hundred thousand dollars, depending on the nature of the violation. If the court determines that unlawful withholding has occurred, it is mandated to award attorney's fees and costs. Whereas the amount of penalties, the court has a lot of discretion in how much it can award for an unlawful withholding. Slide, please. So ways to minimize risk of violating the PRA are on this slide. That doesn't mean the violation is not going to occur, because the PRA is complicated and judges even disagree on how to interpret exemptions and apply them. But ways that the agency can minimize risk of violating the PRA is setting aside a lot of time to conduct a thorough search and searching hard copies and electronic files. I have seen staff set aside time on their calendars where they can just dedicate time to searching for responsive records. Following the public records coordinator's instructions carefully and asking questions. So working very closely with your public records coordinator, who I believe is Nikki. I think it's Nikki. And when in doubt, forwarding potentially responsive documents to your coordinator, even if you think an exemption applies. And I say that because the Information Governance Unit has received extensive training from our office and also from other entities on how to correctly interpret PRA exemptions. So even when you have a document that might be attorney-client privileged, for example, it's important that if it's responsive, to go ahead and send it over so that the Information Governance Unit can take a look at it. And they will also determine whether or not the PRA exemption applies. And if it's something like attorney-client privilege or attorney work product, the IGU has been trained to reach out to our office and consult with us to make sure that those exemptions are correctly applied. And letting them know if you think an exemption applies to a responsive record that you're providing is really helpful in making sure that exempted information is not inadvertently disclosed. Communicating documents is really important. Because, you know, one of the main things that superior courts look at, aside from looking at the statutory interpretations and analyzing those, is to determine whether or not the agency has responded reasonably and provided fullest assistance to the requester. And that requires lots of communication, both internally and externally. And, you know, as an attorney, you know, and a litigator, my view is documenting is really, really important, because over time, people's memories fade, especially when we're talking about things like whether or not you provided a document in response to a public records request, where a lawsuit might not occur for a year or more after the fact. Slide, please. So the Public Records Act is not the only mechanism by which an agency might be required to provide information. And I wanted to make sure to cover discovery rules, because I know that the WDFW staff and the commission receive prompts under the PRA and also the discovery rules. And it's important to know sort of how they overlap and what the difference is. So basically, discovery is a mechanism. It's a process for parties to litigation to share information. It's an organized way of making sure that people are prepared to present their case and also to ensure, and this is of course in an ideal situation, that the philosophy behind it, to also ensure that courts receive all the information that's relevant to issues that are put before it. There's lots of overlap between the PRA and discovery. Both require agencies to provide records upon request. In discovery, you'll see records requests submitted in the form of interrogatories, requests for production, requests for admission or subpoenas, and both impose sanctions for failing to comply. In the realm of discovery, failure to comply with those rules can result in monetary sanctions, but depending on the egregiousness of the failure to comply, can also result in exclusion of evidence. So WDFW, for example, this has never happened, it's my knowledge, but WDFW could be prevented from calling witnesses in its case. The difference is, of course, the Public Records Act always applies and is triggered when any member of the public provides submits a public records request to the agency, whereas the discovery rules are specifically triggered when there's been a lawsuit and an agency is a party to that lawsuit and there's a request for information submitted as a part of that particular process. Slide, please. And you would think that because there is a specific mechanism in litigation for sharing information, that it would not be appropriate for a party to litigation to submit a public records request for the same information it can get through litigation. Well, this issue has been litigated, and I'm calling attention to this Supreme Court decision, Washington State Supreme Court decision, that involved a tort case. So essentially, a child was harmed while being held in a juvenile correction facility, and the parent filed a tort lawsuit. And while that tort lawsuit was pending, the plaintiff's attorney sent multiple public records requests to the Attorney General's office for the same information they were trying to get through the litigation. And this turned into a big fight. The Attorney General's office denied the request, said you have to submit discovery. It went to the Superior Court several times. The Superior Court kept telling the plaintiff's attorney, please stop submitting public records requests for this information. We're going to quash these requests. You have to use discovery rules. And then the Washington Supreme Court granted direct review, meaning that the parties didn't have to go through the Court of Appeals. It just went straight up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court disagreed with the state and with the Superior Court. Slide, please. And basically said, you know, the civil rules are incorporated into the PRA as another statute. There's no conflict. In the PRA, as with discovery, records not relevant and privileged are not disclosed. And then they went on to say records relevant to a controversy to which an agency is a party are exempt from public disclosure if they would not be available to another party under the Superior Court rules for pretrial discovery. Meaning, if you can't get a record through discovery and litigation, you can't get that record through the PRA. That's essentially what that means. However, records relevant to a controversy to which an agency is a party are not exempt if they are available to another party under the Superior Court rules of pretrial discovery, which means that a public record that is open and discoverable is also subject to the PRA. And interestingly enough, you know, just because a PRA exemption applies doesn't mean that it's not disclosable through discovery. So there are some slight differences that can get confusing over time. So what do we mean by privileged? Next slide, please. When we're talking about privilege in the context of litigation that involves WDFW, we're usually talking about attorney-client privilege communications and attorney work product. Attorney-client privilege is governed by RCW, whereas attorney work product is governed by the Civil Discovery Rules, CR 26. Slide, please. And broadly speaking, attorney-client privilege communication is protected if it is a communication, so back and forth, made between privileged persons in confidence for the purpose of obtaining or providing legal assistance to the client. So this basically covers any time an agency reaches out to its assigned AAG with a legal question. That's clearly covered under attorney-client privilege. However, it's not triggered when necessarily when sending a document to an attorney as an FYI or when including people who are outside the agency in the communications. And the privilege can be waived. It can be waived intentionally by the client, by the agency, or it can be waived inadvertently by the agency. For example, by doing, as I said, copying someone on an email outside of the agency, which, as Joe Panesco kind of alluded to, opens the door to a requester, any member of the public, to seek all the communications. So it's basically like, if you accidentally release attorney-client privilege communication and you waive it, then whoever you release that information to can come back and say, okay, well, what else did your attorney tell you? And that's essentially what that waiver does. Slide, please. And then attorney work product is governed by CR 26, like I said. It covers documents and tangible things, which it's pretty broad. Essentially, it's any memorialization prepared in anticipation of litigation that reflects the mental impressions, conclusions, opinions, or legal theories of an attorney. And it doesn't have to be a document created by an attorney. It can be a document created by the client. But if it's being created for the litigation or in anticipation of the litigation, then it can be covered under attorney work product. I essentially like to think of attorney work product as if litigation is a football game. Attorney work product is the playbook and attorney work product is the huddle. And it belongs to both the attorney and the client. Slide, please. So when you're trying to figure out if a record is exempt as an attorney work product, you might think about whether or not it concerns an issue of particular contention where you think litigation is coming down the road. Or if it's on a litigation hold or it concerns a subject that is on a litigation hold, then it might be attorney work product. And litigation holds notices that our office provides to WDFW alerting the agency to preserve records that are related to the subject of anticipated or ongoing litigation. It describes the records to be withheld. It provides instructions on how to preserve those records. They're issued, like I said, whenever there's reasonable anticipation of a lawsuit. It's really important to pay attention to those litigation holds. I believe that there's a litigation and discovery coordinator that WDFW employs. You've seen emails from Susan Lassiter. She transmits litigation holds. And it's very, very important to follow them and to pay attention to them because agencies can face severe sanctions for accidentally destroying a record that is discoverable in ongoing litigation. Slide, please. And this is different. This is the last slide, different from your General Records Retention Act obligations. So we've talked about a few things. We've talked about the PRA and records subject to a pending PRA have to be preserved. We've talked about attorney work product and litigation records subject to records subject to a litigation hold that must be preserved. And that's distinct from records that have to be preserved pursuant to the General Records Retention Act, which is RCW 4014. So basically the Washington Secretary of State sets a general records retention schedule for agencies to follow. WDFW has a more specific records retention schedule to follow. And basically what that records retention schedule does is it says, okay, for certain categories of records, here's the minimum period of time you have to retain those records. Once that records retention period is passed, the agency can destroy the records, except if those records are subject to a litigation hold or if there is a pending public records request. There are penalties for intentionally and willfully destroying records in violation of the Records Retention Act. Okay, and that's all I have. It's a lot packed into a small amount of time. So I'm happy to take questions when that's time if you want. Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren. So that concludes the public records portion. So I do encourage any of the commissioners who have questions on that particular topic to raise those now. Timing wise, we're really good on our time with our presentation material. And I'm just going to highlight. So the commissioners will be receiving on a regular basis for those commissioners who've been around for a while, you know it, for the new commissioners, just that, you know, the heads up, you will be seeing regular public records request notices transmitted through your executive assistant, and also discovery holds on much litigation. You will see those. So these obligations fall on your shoulders individually, just like all the rest of the agency employees, to be diligent about your record management for all the records that you come into possession of as a Fish and Wildlife Commissioner.
So we have two folks with their hands up. Yeah, first, Commissioner Coons, and then Lorna Smith.
First, thanks for the presentations. That was really very useful. A question about emails and whether they're immediately, if there's not a litigation hold, are they immediately disposable? And does both the sender and the receiver, or the sender and the receiver, right, you know, have different records hold lengths?
Thank you for the question, Commissioner Coons. I would say emails are not automatically destructible, even if there's not a pending public records request or litigation hold. It depends on the content of the email. So scheduling emails that might be construed as transitory, you can delete those when you don't have a business need for them. But otherwise, they would fall under the records retention schedule, just like any other record maintained by the agency.
And I'll just add on top of that, the Attorney General's office, like Fish and Wildlife, has its own records retention schedule. So when we, and in our office, the obligation is on the sender of the email, not necessarily the recipient. So we focus on who originated it. Mm-hmm. But I have to look at all of our different categories. If I'm sending an email, if it involves a case, it has a different retention schedule. If it involves client advice, it has a different retention schedule. And we actually have an email folder structure where I can save the copy of my sent item in the appropriate category that's subject to the appropriate retention hold, 6 years, 10 years, whatnot.
Okay. Commissioner Smith?
Boy, I don't like the sound of that. I hope we don't, you know, wow, I can't get rid of that there. I hope we don't have to set up a system like that with all these different categories of email. If we do, I'm going to need training just on that, I'm afraid. A lot of what we will have in our possession, emails, documents, are likely to be in the possession of someone in the department. You know, a lot of it was initiated probably by someone in the department. So it sounds like we would not be the first stop for looking for those records as part of the public information request. But would you have to, let's say whoever's in charge of gathering up these documents, would they say to us as a commissioner, hey, show us everything you have on, I don't know, north of Falcon, or hopefully it's not, hopefully it's more specific than that, but do we have to produce those even though we were not the initiator and they're shared with a whole, you know, they've been shared with a whole lot of other people? Because that's a lot of what we have, right?
Thank you, Commissioner Smith. So that's a really good question. I would say, yes, you would still need to search and produce those records, because even though other folks in the agency will likely have copies of those records, the agency still has to search all places where responsive records are likely to be maintained, even if they're duplicates, which I know presents some complications process-wise. But you very well may get a request for records that are responsive to a public records request. And even if you think other people have responsive records, we would recommend that you go ahead and search and provide whatever you have in response to that request.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you just suggested north of Falcon. The agency has received very broad requests for all documents associated with north of Falcon. And one of those requests was submitted, I think, in 2016 or 2017, and that request is still open. because there are so many tens of thousands of pages of potentially responsive records that the agency is still searching for them and turning them over in batches. And the requester filed a lawsuit challenging the agency's response time, saying you're taking too long. And we won at Superior Court with the judge. And actually, Lauren's very much aware of that case. She defended that. So what happens? And so, I mean, the public may not realize the scope of workload that the Public Records Act imposes on state agencies. You have quite a few employees who are full-time employees dealing with these issues because it is so massive and overwhelming sometimes.
Deputy Director Windrup.
Okay, I just wanted to thank you, Chair Carpenter. I just wanted to point the commissioners, all the commissioners, to our internal intranet site. And if you go to our intranet site, there is a drop down for, I think it's services, and you go over to the IGU unit, and there are trainings in the IGU unit. There's a really nice graphic about what's transitory. There's a retention schedule. I recommend that all y'all become familiar with that which is found on our intranet around the IGU. Carissa is she's our records management manager, and she is extremely helpful. And if you do want help setting up a system that will make your life easier, I'm sure Carissa would be willing to help you do that. So we have a lot of resources. We've gotten very good at this. Lauren has done an amazing job defending us, and I really am proud of the work we've done to strengthen our PRA compliance. So it's serious business. We do it with all the intention of transparency. And basically, when I write anything anywhere at any time, I assume that it is for all to see. Mm-hmm. So there's just a desire for transparency that we all hold at the department. And I just want to exhort you to sort of own that with us. Because frankly, you own the liability. We're all in it together on this one.
Yeah. And it's also for the reason there's always been a strong encouragement to commissioners to utilize their assigned dfw.wa.gov email domain, because emails in that domain can be searched digitally by the Information Governance Unit directly without needing to rely upon you to do it individually. So that's strongly encourage commissioners to use and solely use your assigned department email domain. You're not legally required to. If you have your own email account and choose to use that as a commissioner for work purposes, then you are going to shoulder all of the responsibility 100% to diligently search that repository, because department staff won't have access to your private email repository. And also why we also strongly recommend that you separate any personal email for personal purposes from an email for commission purposes. Again, because you don't want to have the obligation to segregate those things out, as the deputy is showing, it's, you know, separate work phone and personal phone. Same thing, text messages are difficulty. So, all right. I see no other hands up. So thank you, Lauren. That was great. Right on time. Oh, Commissioner Coons? Nope. Okay. So we are going to move over to the Public Meetings Act, which I've talked about a little bit in prior sessions with the commission. Yes.
Lorna's hand went back up.
Commissioner Smith.
When you said phone, it prompted me to think of something else. I regularly and quickly delete phone messages and text messages so they don't bog down my phone. Should we not be doing that? I mean, do we need to think about what we're deleting or?
Thank you, Commissioner Smith. Yes, please do not automatically delete text messages. If you're texting about agency business, we would recommend that. I think there's a way to copy and paste the content of those text messages into a Word document. Yeah. So if there's a way to save those, and particularly save those on a sequestered repository for agency records as opposed to personal records, that would be recommended.
Yeah, it's our legal advice has always been to try to minimize the use of text messages for work purposes, because the document management obligations for dealing with that are very, very difficult. In the Attorney General's office, when we are issued work cell phones, the text messaging is disabled. our office's policy is just like, we're not going to have it. We're not going to struggle with the headache of managing those kinds of records, which are so typically thought of as transitory, but the obligation to save them is all context dependent. If the context of the text puts it into a longer record retention category, then you do have the obligation to be saving it in accordance with the retention schedule.
Gotcha.
All right. I'm going to jump to the next one, Open Public Meetings Act. So this Open Public Meeting Act training that I'm going to jump into is actually, it's a slideshow that other attorneys in our office have generated that they have used for training both state officials and local officials. And this training does comply with the statutory mandate under the OPMA that a newly appointed member of a governing body take OPMA training. So this satisfies it. And then the statutory obligation is also that any other member of a governing body who started off and got that training initially, they're supposed to renew it. I misspoke in a prior conversation with at least some commissioners. I'd said every 3 years. I double checked the statute last night. It's every 4 years you're supposed to renew it. So this satisfies that obligation for all the rest of the commissioners who have had it at one point before. So let me get to my share screen. And I did shorten the slides a little bit because this was a more generic slideshow indicated for all levels of government. So to the extent that there were slides talking about, well, are you governed by this or not? I've tried to take out a lot of that. The Fish and Wildlife Commission is clearly governed by it. There's no question about it. So we're not going to spend a lot of time worrying about that. So the Washington's Open Public Meetings Act was passed in 1971, very contemporaneous with the Public Records Act. There was a nationwide effort to make government affairs more open, accessible, and responsive. The Open Public Meetings Act, which is codified in RCW Chapter 4230, requires meetings to be open to the public, gavel to gavel, subject to, once again, narrow exemptions. Just like the Public Records Act, the presumption is open, unless there's an exemption and exemptions are narrowly construed. Exact same philosophy with the Open Public Meetings Act. The presumption should be that if you trigger an open public, if your actions are triggering the Open Public Meetings Act, then the presumption should be that everything should be open thereafter, unless you meet one of the narrow exemptions. There had been an open meetings law previously at a different location in the statutes. It was very limited in its scope, had almost no teeth whatsoever. And the philosophy is transparency in government builds public confidence in government. This is a quote straight out of the statute. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But again, the people preserve their sovereignty and hold the sovereignty. The government officials don't know better than the public. The public have the right to track what's going on. That's my 5-second summary. So the OPMA applies to all meetings of governing body of a public agency, and they have to be open, and public have to be permitted to attend. What is a governing body? Well, I modified this because on the left side, the Fish and Wildlife Commission is a governing body anytime you have a quorum. And by statute for the Fish and Wildlife Commission, that quorum is 5 members. So anytime you have 5 members or more gathered and you say a single word of agency business, that is a meeting that triggers the Open Public Meetings Act obligations. Now, the or on the right-hand side, if the full commission forms a committee and delegates the committee the authority to make decisions, and the committee with that delegation is acting on behalf of the commission, then that committee could be triggering the OPMA, even if it's not the statutory quorum of 5. If you have a committee of 3 and the full commission says, go do this and bring us back something to act on, then it's a full delegation, not merely, oh, just give us a recommendation, but remove everything and just come back with one thing and exclude the rest. That could trigger it. And I'm not familiar in my short time frame of advising the commission, I'm not aware of the commission having delegated to a committee any authority that would trigger this. If there was a smaller committee that conducted formal hearings or formally took testimony or public comment, that too could trigger the OPMA for the actions of that smaller committee. And again, I'm not aware of any actions by the Fish and Wildlife Commission that kick over onto the right side of that table. So what is a public agency slide? Not going to worry about the language in the statute. Fish and Wildlife Commission clearly fits the definition. The OPMA does not apply to other entities like the judiciary, courts, doesn't apply to the legislature. It doesn't apply to agencies that if they don't fit within the definition of public agency, such as agencies governed by a single individual. Department of Ecology, for example, is headed by an individual appointed by the governor. There is not a governing body acting within the Department of Ecology that triggers OPMA. And this only applies to governmental entities, both state and local, does not apply to private organizations or federal or tribal. Other kinds of activities that an agency, even a governing body, might do that do not trigger OPMA. So some governing bodies, boards and commissions will act in a quasi-judicial capacity. And when they're acting in a quasi-judicial capacity, it doesn't trigger OPMA. The Fish and Wildlife Commission, I am not aware of the Fish and Wildlife Commission acting in a quasi-judicial capacity. It hasn't come up on my radar screen, again, in my short time of advising the commission. When the commission acts on matters governed by the APA, the Washington Administrative Procedure Act, then it is governed by the APA. The APA trumps the OPMA. So for one example, the OPMA for public meetings does not require public testimony. It just requires public attendance. And there have been legislative proposals just this session to amend that and to mandate the right of the public to speak at public meetings. I haven't been tracking any of those bills. I don't know if any of them are still alive within the cutoff calendar. So it's just a heads up. Some legislators believe that the right to speak to the governing body should be part of this, but it's not yet. So you don't have to worry about it just yet. But even though the Public Meetings Act doesn't require public testimony, when you're doing a rulemaking hearing, that requires a public hearing where the people have the opportunity to testify. So that's an example of the APA trumps, and you have to provide an opportunity to speak when you're doing rulemaking hearings. Matters of collective bargaining, which the commission doesn't usually get involved with, that does not trigger OPMA as one of the exceptions. So what is a meeting? It is a meeting anywhere that you have a quorum where you take action. Well, what does that mean? It could be taking public testimony, any kind of discussion, reviewing materials, all deliberations, considering things, evaluating things. And then there's a higher category of final actions, like voting on something. Final actions are even more stringent, but any kind of these actions, just discussion, still triggers the need to have the open public meeting. Let's see here. If you gather with a collective intent of transacting business, well, then that is a meeting. Physical presence is not required. This can occur by phone or, this can be triggered by phone or email. So if you're having a group telephone conversation with five or more, that's a meeting. The public have the right to listen in. And this is why we tell you don't reply all to emails sent to the commission, because a reply all by any of the commissioners is a discussion. And if you're doing a reply all to five or more commissioners, you are engaging in a discussion that tech public to listen in on that discussion. And it really needs to happen in person or digitally where the public can listen in to that discussion. That covers the next bullet. It doesn't need to be titled to a meeting. Any type of action that involves a quorum or more, that where any discussion or any of those other elements of a meeting or taking action occur, then that triggers it. So it doesn't, if you title a retreat or a workshop or a study session, some of the commissioners have been aware from other discussions that, yeah, that does trigger OPMA. If you want to have a retreat or a workshop, you still have to afford the public the right to observe and hear what's going on. And this only applies if you have a quorum. Final action is the collective position or negative decision on an actual vote by the majority of the governing body. Final action must always be taken in public, even if deliberations occurred in closed session and you cannot do secret ballots. One of the places where this can get contentious is, for example, hiring decisions. In your case, the commission hires the director, and while initial evaluations and reviews of a potential director, some of those can happen in private, the final decision to hire a new director has to occur on the record. And that can be challenging because sometimes when you're interviewing for a position, other individuals who want to apply might be gainfully employed elsewhere, and they really would not like their employer to know that they're putting in for another job. But there's only so much you can do to protect that, because at some point their identity may well become part of the public decision-making process on which candidate you wish to hire. traveling and gathering. So there is language in the OPMA that says a majority of the members of the governing body may travel together and gather for purposes other than a regular meeting or a special meeting, so long as no action is taken. So if you want to have a dinner over at someone's house, legally you can do that, but you can't talk business. As soon as you start talking business, then you run into problems. So if, you know, I'm not going to tell you what you can or can't do, but if you all gather, the question is, can you do that diligently and never start talking anything to do with your fish and wildlife business? That's the challenge. So it's risky. General OPMA meeting types. There's regular meetings, special and emergency. We've got slides talking about each of those. Regular meetings are the ones that are recurring meetings held in accordance with whatever you decide your schedule is. For some entities, it's set by ordinance, resolution, bylaws, or other rule. For the Fish and Wildlife Commission, you guys work on your year at a glance. You come up with a schedule, you plan it. So the commission sets its own schedule for regular meetings. And then your executive assistant does file that the yearly calendar with the code revisor, which is part of the requirement for regular meetings, that you need to have a yearly calendar of those filed with the code revisor. And you can make changes to that schedule. You're supposed to make those changes at least 20 days prior to the date of the scheduled meeting. Agenda notices. So the agenda, that you have an obligation to issue an agenda for your regular meetings. It's in the statute. It requires them to make the agenda available online no more than 24 hours in advance of the start of the meeting. However, you have flexibility. The law does not bind you to the agenda. You can make modifications in the agenda if you need to. From a transparency and a public perspective, or public policy perspective, it may not be wise to add a new agenda item and take a final vote on something without notice to the public, but it may not be illegal to do it. The law does not invalidate actions taken at a regular meeting, even if the agenda was not properly posted. And if you have other legal obligations to provide public notice for something that you're doing, like the APA, you can't point to OPMA rules and say, well, we satisfied OPMA, so we satisfied other legal obligations. Other legal obligations could also apply. That, you know, that's one of my roles, is to help you be aware of what those other legal obligations are and work with your executive assistant to make sure that those are being complied with. If you don't follow the agenda or you don't post the agenda, that is not a basis for attorney's fees or a court order. So the agenda has a lot of flexibility, fortunately, for regular meetings. When you go to special meetings, a special meeting is a meeting that you can schedule anytime you need to. It's simply a meeting that is not on the regular calendar. It can be called by a presiding officer or majority of the members. You only have to notice it 24 hours before the meeting occurs. Written notice must be given to the members unless they waive the notice. The department is supposed to have a list of interested media who've requested notice of meetings, and the notice is supposed to be distributed to whomever is on that list, posted to your website, prominently displayed at the main entrance, the agency's principal location, and meeting site if it's a different location. And the note here, all of these slides are not involving COVID exceptions. The OPMA obligations were modified by a governor's proclamation. Those modifications are still in place because the state legislature this winter endorsed the governor's modifications. So they're going to stay in place as long as the governor says so, as long as the emergency proclamation is in place. And I'm not going to talk about those details for purposes of this presentation, because I'm just hoping, fingers crossed, that we get out of this soon and we're back in person and working under these regular statutes. Special meetings. The notice must specify the time, place, and the business to be transacted, the agenda. You cannot take final disposition at any other item if it's not listed on the agenda. And this is actually a clarification. When I was looking at this, it's like the restriction for special meetings is you can't take final disposition on anything else. You technically could talk about something else not on the agenda as long as it's just a discussion. The final disposition is the strict statutory bar. Emergency meetings is on spur of the moment, major disaster. You got to get together to make a decision on something. Then you have a lot more flexibility. Public attendance. The agency cannot place conditions on the public to attend a meeting subject to the OPMA. You cannot require people to register their names or other information, complete a questionnaire, or otherwise fulfill any condition precedent to attendance. So for people who want to, and again, you know, there are some exemptions with the COVID stuff has sort of changed things with the digital realm. With Zoom with the registration option asks people to put in their names. So they could say, oh, you're violating the OPMA. Well, however, people can also watch the meeting through TVW without doing the registration. So there's still an option for people to view the meetings without putting in any information. And this is just to attend or in a digital realm view. You can require people to provide their name and sign up to speak. That is very clear. And because you need to have a reasonable means to manage your agenda. Reasonable rules of conduct can be set for your meetings. Cameras and tape recorders are permitted. The public can come in with cameras or tape recorders and run them however they want to, unless they become disruptive. And there has been some case law, usually on the local government level, where they have disruptions. And the question is how much control can the governing body exercise over that? As I said before, there is no public comment required by the OPMA, but other statutes, agency specific or like APA, may require that if it's a hearing. Interruptions and disruptions, you can deal with them in a reasonable fashion. I'm not going to get into the details on this. This hasn't been an issue for the Fish and Wildlife Commission in my time frame. But if it comes up, there is case law out there that I can turn to provide you more detailed guidance to the facts of the circumstance. Executive session. So executive session is that part of a meeting that you can close to the public. It is limited to specific purposes listed in the statute. And at the beginning of the executive session, which we're actually going to go into when this training is done, there will be an announcement by the chair that specifies the purpose of the executive session and what time it will end. And then the chair will go back on the record to public to formally end the public meeting when we're done with that. And if we need to extend it, then we've had to do that before. There are many different specific things listed in the OPMA for executive session. The only ones that I'm going to touch on really quickly are the one in red on this page, evaluate qualifications of applicant for public employment. And that can include reviewing the performance of a person who you've hired. So when the commission does reviews of the director's performance, it can do that in executive session. And that is a more common one for the commission to invoke. One more page, and it's legal advice. Discuss agency enforcement actions, litigation, or potential litigation. And there's three requirements there. I'm not going to take the time to read through them because I have to know them when I'm advising you on whether you can go into executive session on it or not. And I try to keep you on good terms with the law when it comes to this. Individual members of the governing body can be held personally liable for violations of the OPMA. Up to $500 civil penalty for a first violation if for knowingly attending a meeting that is violating the OPMA, and $1,000 for a subsequent knowing violation. And there can be costs and attorney's fees awarded to a plaintiff who files a lawsuit to challenge OPMA compliance. So like the Public Records Act, this is important stuff. And the legislature has shown through the pocketbook how important this is, because if you don't comply with this, you are opening yourself up to personal liability and significant attorney's fees. And furthermore, actions taken at meetings in violation of the OPMA can be declared null and void. Minutes. There is a statutory obligation to take minutes of the meeting, but the statute is silent as to how comprehensive or summary the minutes can be. And I have found no case law offering any further guidance on that. One of the things you will notice with Fish and Wildlife Commission, if you look on the website of prior meetings, you will find the written minutes, which are then, you know, your executive assistant prepares draft minutes during the meeting. And then at the next meeting, usually, sometimes it gets kicked out due to agenda constraints. But eventually, the executive assistant will bring those draft minutes back to the body for final approval. And then those get posted to the website. And there will be a note in the written minutes saying that these written minutes plus the recordings of the meetings constitute the formal record of the meetings. And that is acceptable. The OPMA does not mandate recordings, but it's certainly allowed, and it helps capture what happened by having a full recording. And since there is a full recording that anyone can view, TVW, when they record these, they keep them in archives. I think in some sense that takes a little bit of pressure off of trying to capture things more specifically in the written minutes, because it's hard work taking good minutes. I mean, you almost need a court transcriptionist, even if you're not going to do a full transcript, just capturing the gist of it. You really, if you're going to do that level of detail, you pretty much need to have one staff person dedicated to that task during the meeting. Presently, you have one executive assistant who's handling a whole lot of different things during the scope of the meeting, managing public testimony and other functions, and having more detailed minutes coming from that single person with all the additional obligations of managing these meetings is a really tough ask. You don't have to take minutes of an executive session. So risk management tips, establish a culture of compliance with the OPMA, and that's not been an issue with Fish and Wildlife. For example, the committee meetings that the commission holds, they're designed to be four member committees, so they are not a quorum. So they technically can occur without triggering OPMA as long as it's just the four commissioners. But as a matter of policy choice, the commission has decided to make its committee meetings open to the public and to comply fully with the OPMA for those committee meetings. So there is a strong culture of transparency and compliance with the OPMA that I've observed in working with the commission. And just part of my role as your legal advisor to help keep you updated on current developments in OPMA and correctly apply the law. The law can change. Other laws can govern an agency's meeting procedures, and consult with me and other AAGs in our group when things come up. This just talks about the training requirements, which I've already covered. This slideshow constitutes successful training. The Attorney General's office maintains additional resources at the website listed there, or you can just go to atg.wa.gov and just search for open public government, and you should be able to find the link. And there are other resources. Our office has a document called the Washington State Sunshine Laws, last updated 2016, and it's Open Government Resource Manual. That manual covers both public records and OPMA. There is a specific guide, which I haven't needed to work with in my short time advising the commission, on filling vacant positions when you are an OPMA entity. Finally, the Municipal Research Services Center, MRSC, has a lot. And so they're a central body to support Washington State local governments on legal issues. And they have a ton of resources on these types of things. Those are just, you know, little images of the different resources they have on Open Public Meetings Act. And those can be found online, available to anybody in the public as well. So that ends the OPMA presentation. 20 minutes. Woohoo! That was what I was shooting for. Any other OPMA questions on this? We've put you to sleep. All right. Well, with that, I will turn it over to Amy, who does not have a lot of slides, and we'll get into the last few procedural law issues that you get to deal with regularly as a commission.
All right, good afternoon, everyone. And either Joe or Nikki, let's pull back. Oh, there we are. Very good.
Pulling it up.
So I have good news. You're in the home stretch. I am covering three statutes, but I'm going to cover them at a very high level. And we'll start with the Administrative Procedure Act. And the main focus that I'm going to really talk the most about today is rulemaking. But before I get into that, I wanted to just give a little bit of a larger perspective about the Administrative Procedure Act. You'll hear the APA referenced regularly. The overarching purpose is to provide clarity and reliability in agency practices. There's been some form of the Administrative Procedure Act, both in federal and in state law, for many, many decades. And in our Administrative Procedure Act in the state of Washington, it really focuses on two types of actions: rulemakings and adjudications, but there is reference to essentially a grab bag of other agency actions, and they call them that, other agency actions. So for rulemakings, that can be a rule that's created by the Fish and Wildlife Commission. The director has some authority to issue rules as well. Some of that is delegated from the Fish and Wildlife Commission, but there are a few statutory provisions that directly give rulemaking authority to the director, and that is subject specific. The thing that I want you all to keep in mind about rules is they're a little bit like mini laws. They establish broadly applicable requirements. So compared to a permit, which is specific to a single person, a rule applies across the board to a category of people. And because of that, we want to have procedures that allow those people to whom the rule may apply an opportunity to comment on and participate in the process that's going to create this rule. Examples that you all do fairly frequently, hunting rules. One big one that was just done was the commercial whale watching licensing rule that established a whole new chapter in the WAC for WDFW. And the key principles are notice to the public and an opportunity to comment. And I'll talk a little bit more about rulemakings later on in this presentation. Adjudications, I just have a couple of things because this is not something that you do as Fish and Wildlife Commissioners. I believe, and Joe will clarify if necessary, the Office of Administrative Hearings for the State of Washington is handling most, if not all, of WDFW's adjudications now. And it addresses a discrete dispute between a person and the agency. An example might be a permit revocation, and it'll be handled similarly to a court case. And you have the same types of rules that apply, and the key principles there are fairness and due process. For other agency actions, I'm not going to talk much about that. You do other agency actions as a Fish and Wildlife Commission as a whole. Approvals of budgets, land transactions, policy adoptions, appointment of the director, delegations of authority, actions on petitions for rulemaking, all of those things potentially are other agency actions. One thing just to note about that, that also includes a failure to act. So if there is a requirement, for example, to act on a petition for rulemaking, someone could potentially bring a lawsuit under the APA for a failure to act on that if WDFW didn't act on it. To my knowledge, you all always do take action within the statutory time for that. Next slide, please. So now I'm going to talk about rulemaking procedures more because that's really what you all do mostly. Fair notice is one of the linchpins for the rulemaking process. And there are essentially forms that are created by the code reviser that WDFW staff handles taking care of. And a useful way to think about the rulemaking process is that you start broad and it gets narrower and narrower until you get to the final rule. So the pre-notice inquiry, which is sometimes you'll hear referred to as a CR 101, is really quite broad, and it's an opportunity to let the public know the agency is starting to think about a potential rulemaking, but it doesn't get into the specifics of, oh, we're going to suggest this specifically, and it doesn't have language that will potentially become a final rule. That only happens later on at the CR 102 phase. And the CR 102 is actually really quite specific. It'll have a specific proposal. And if you're looking at this little funneled diamond, you can think about that as being pretty far down in the process, but you're not to the final decision yet, because now there's going to be an opportunity for public comment. And by statute, there needs to be both an opportunity to provide written comment and also oral public hearing comment. And the commission needs to consider that as well. Oftentimes what WDFW staff will do is they will provide a summary for the commission. They will go through and they review all of the comments that have been submitted during the written comment period. And then obviously you all have the opportunity to hear the oral public hearing testimony. Then you will have a final decision, and that will happen as Joe was referring to under the OPMA, that needs to happen in a public session because it is a decision and rules are adopted by a majority of the Fish and Wildlife members. If a rule is adopted, then there's additional procedures You'll have a CR103 filed with the code revisor. And very importantly, from our perspective, is that there's a concise explanatory statement that's going to explain both WDFW's response to comments and explain how the variations, if there are any, from the proposed rule to the final are actually limited. And this is a really important point that I want to touch on for you all. Because comment, notice and comment is so important, you cannot vary substantially from the CR102 when you're enacting the final rule. Now, if the commission wanted to take a different approach after having heard public testimony, certainly you have the opportunity to either withdraw the CR102 or to file a supplemental CR102. But after doing that, you're going to want to provide additional opportunities for public comment. If someone in the public believes that the final rule, the CR103, substantially differs from the CR102, they can petition to have that reviewed first by WDFW and potentially bring a court case challenging that the final rule differed too substantially from what the CR102 was. I also just want to note for you all that there are emergency rules and the procedures there vary, and they're available only under very limited circumstances. An emergency rule is going to be temporary. It can't be more than 120 days in effect. And it also needs to occur only if there's good cause that goes to preserving public health, safety, or general welfare, and that there wasn't an opportunity or there isn't sufficient time to have notice and opportunity to comment before it's necessary to have the rule in place because of the public interest. Now, this does happen in the fishing context fairly frequently because of conservation concerns. All right, let's go to the next slide. Don't get overwhelmed. So,
can I ask a question before you move on, please?
Yeah.
So you said that if there's a petition, it can be, and we make a decision, that decision can be appealed by going to court. But since I've been on the commission, we've had two petition decisions overturned by the governor.
Yes. And there is a provision for if someone seeks to have a rule reviewed by the governor has an opportunity to do that. And after that, then there's the potential of going to court if the governor doesn't act. Is that helpful?
Thank you. That explains
okay.
It.
Amy, Commissioner Kuntz has a question.
Yes, Commissioner Kuntz.
Yeah, I'm a little confused about making changes to a CR102.
Yes.
I think you said like minor changes. So like if we had a public meeting on CR102 and took public comments, small changes can be made in the time frame until the next meeting, say, and the 103 is presented.
So,
by significant changes,
right? How do you tell what counts as a substantial versus a minor change? It's a bit of a gray area, but there's three core matters to think about. One is who is impacted. You do not want to change the scope of who would be impacted by the rules. So saying someone new is going to be regulated, let's say you had a proposal to regulate fishermen who are focusing on salmon, and then there was a thought, well, why don't we expand it further to cover fishermen of other species? Well, that would be a potential substantial difference, and the people who are going to be regulated didn't have initial notice. So that would be a concern. Another is whether the effect of the proposal will remain the same. And that is a pretty nuanced analysis. generally, I think that so long as what you're talking about, the scope of the effect is going to be similar, and it can be anticipated what the effect will be, then it'll be okay. So for example, in the commercial whale watching context, there were a couple of different options that were floated, and they proposed different days and different time periods when potentially there could be restrictions on viewing whales. And the effect of the rules, even if you change the days slightly or the hours slightly, it would still be within the scope of what would anticipate being the effect of the rule, even if you change the hours and the days slightly. But if you did something much more drastic, arguably that would be outside the scope and the effect would be different. And then finally, the general subject matter, which is pretty obvious. So if you propose a rule about crabbing, you shouldn't change it to then affect fishing or something like that.
Thank you.
So now you've had a chance, all of you, to look at this very complicated flow chart. This is on the Washington State Register's webpage, if you ever want to look at it. It's actually quite thorough. And I don't want to walk through this with all of you, but what I think is most important is for you to realize how complicated this process is. And the Fish and Wildlife Commission has a very key role in reviewing, hearing the public testimony, reviewing comments, and making a decision. But there's a lot of other work that's happening by WDFW staff outside of the context of the meetings and your review of the materials. So if you ever have questions, you are welcome to reach out to the AG's office or to the rules coordinator who works at WDFW. This, I just wanted you all to be able to see how complicated this process is.
And Amy, Commissioners, one moment. Commissioner Smith has her hand up, please.
Yes.
So as I'm looking at this elegant chart, I see over on the left-hand side that public petition for rulemaking. You didn't really talk about that. How does that get initiated?
A person will write to the department and say, I am petitioning for rulemaking. And it can be an amendment. It can be for a brand new rule. And I haven't looked recently at whether how formulaic that needs to be. I can tell you that WDFW generally takes a generous role and will ask someone to clarify what they're asking for and give them the opportunity. And then once it becomes clear that someone is petitioning for rulemaking, there's a time period, which off the top of my head, I don't remember. It might be 60 days or 30 days. 60 days for for the Fish and Wildlife Commission to take action on it.
So anybody can propose anything. And as long as it's as long as it's serious, it has to be considered.
Well, and even if it's not serious, it will be considered. It just may be easier to respond to it. Yes.
Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In that same box that Commissioner Smith is looking at, lower left, petitions denied, the box ends. But what Commissioner Thorburn just mentioned over here in the middle, petition to governor for repeal or emergency rule. So if the commission denies the petition, it's dead. They cannot appeal to the governor. Or is that what happened on the wolf situation or not?
That is a really good question. And I think this flowchart is missing that component of the governor's process. And it's a fairly nuanced process. It applies in some contexts and not in all contexts. I do not have that in front of me, so I'm not going to try and opine about what the specific conditions are. I will note that a similar petition for rulemaking was presented in 2014 related to asking for rules related to wolf livestock conflict. And in that context, the governor's office said, you know, we don't have a role in reviewing this. The commission denied it, and it's not something we're going to look at. This most recent one, because there was a difference in the way that it was presented as a proposed amendment, then the governor viewed that he did have the jurisdiction under the statute to review it. And in that case, he chose to grant the petition.
Not that three or four more boxes and seven more arrows would make this a little easier.
True enough. Other questions about this beautiful diagram? Okay, so let's just move to the last slide. This is the last one on the APA. And I just want to leave you with some key principles. Joe talked about it, and I want to reinforce rules are dependent on statutory authority. So there's any number of ways that the department might start thinking about promulgating a new rule or amending a rule. And it's always important that at an early stage, the department step back and say, what is our statutory authority? How broadly would we act in this area? What has the legislature told us we are allowed to do? Second, always remember that these rules are granting or restricting privileges. These are impacting people. And we will talk in my next slides about some of the other legislative provisions that try and make sure that the when there's rulemaking that occurs, that you think about these things. There's a distinction that is important to make. When a rule sets forth a restrictions on what people may or may not do, or gives them an opportunity to do something they wouldn't otherwise be able to do, then it certainly is granting or restricting a privilege, and you need to have go through the entire notice and comment period. Sometimes you all have internal commission policies, and those may ultimately have some sort of impact on future rules. But if it's a policy, it does not necessarily get reviewed at the policy level. There's a lot of nuances to that issue. So if there is a specific situation where you're thinking about a policy, please talk to the AG's office and we'll give you advice about that. Just a couple other points. Some of those rulemakings that you do are regularly scheduled. Others occur only one time. And most importantly, when you're thinking about a rule, it should be clear and it should be enforceable. So if you read something and you don't understand what the rule is, definitely raise that because you want the general public to be able to understand it. And you have a lot more knowledge than the general public. All right. Any other questions about the APA before I move on and I touch on the SEPA? All right, so State Environmental Policy Act. This comes up occasionally in your work. The whole purpose of SEPA is to inform agency decisions by evaluating potential adverse environmental impacts of a proposed action and alternatives as well. And SEPA applies only if there's an action. So it's important to remember that there has to be some sort of action that is going to be evaluated, a proposal. And also, it only applies if there's no categorical exemption. So WDFW has multiple categorical exemptions that apply. It's in the SEPA rules. If you want to go and look at those, WAC 197-11-835. There's also general categorical exemptions at 800, and there's some statutory categorical exemptions. So SEPA does not always apply, but it does sometimes, and it can be an important tool and impact the decisions that you're going to be making. So within the realm of SEPA actions, there's basically two pools. You have a project actions and you have the non-project actions. Project actions are perhaps what you think of more typically when you think about SEPA analysis. It could be building a new stadium, building a highway, adding a runway to an airport. All of those things are discrete projects. It could be issuing a permit. There's also what we call non-project actions, and those are things that are more broad, and it's usually planning activities, so promulgating a rule, a WAC. It can also be developing a management plan. And WDFW's policy is to try and do as much of its CEPA work at the non-project stage, because so much of the on-the-ground work is actually subject to categorical exemptions, which makes sense. Like, you don't want to go through CEPA to do on-the-ground management of wildlife, because, you know, the wildlife will have moved on and gone somewhere else. Oftentimes the work that WDFW is doing on the ground is very time sensitive. So the focus is on doing CEPA at the non-project action level.
Amy, Commissioner Thorburn has a question.
Yes, Commissioner Thorburn.
And Chair Carpenter. Is any area of CEPA a delegation from federal action? Perhaps that affects ecology more. Is there any area in DFW where we're delegated to use CEPA?
I'm not sure that I understood your question, so I'm going to say a couple of things, and then you will clarify how I did not answer your question. So there is NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, and it is possible that a NEPA analysis, the federal analysis, can actually satisfy the CEPA requirements, and there's mechanisms for using NEPA and adopting those, basically those decisions, into the CEPA process. And you mentioned ecology. So the Department of Ecology is charged with implementing all of the rules for CEPA. And so the CEPA rules that are listed here under Chapter 197, 11 WAC, those are all promulgated by ecology. WDFW does have some of its own CEPA regulations in terms of how it administers its own CEPA program, like its preferences for example, that they're going to focus on doing CEPA at the non-project action. But the WDFW does not have authority to do broader CEPA regulations in the way that the Department of Ecology does.
Yeah, that pretty much touches on it. I was thinking of some ecology permitting, I think, is a federal delegation. It sounds like it's sort of the reverse with NEPA and, say, Endangered Species Act. We could rely on the NEPA analysis, but they would never rely on a CEPA analysis in their work.
There's a very narrow provision where there's joint funding between a federal and a state project. And to my knowledge, it doesn't come up with WDFW. Maybe it could in the context of a land development issue. But Kim, I think that you're right. It's generally not something that's going to be an issue here for WDFW.
Amy?
I see, Lorna, do you have your hand up?
Yes. Yes. I have a question, but I also was just going to respond to Kim and say, I think she might be thinking about the Clean Water Act 401 process where DOE has been delegated certain authority from EPA to administer that federal program. So that does happen sometimes. And also there, you know, when I worked in Snohomish County, we did a lot of NEPA-CEPA combined documents. So that also can be done. But my question was, if you could address the issue of shelf life on SEPA documents. And I know there's not just one answer for that, but is there case law guidance or something about when you can no longer rely, you know, for a new action on some old SEPA review? What is the, you know, kind of rule of thumb there?
Sure. Let's go to the next slide where I have listed out some of the SEPA documents. So there is no rule of thumb to this first. It really depends on whether there's been a substantial change in the circumstances, not in a time period. So it could, you know, in my mind, hypothetically, you could have a change of circumstances within a couple of months from a SEPA document being developed, or you could go years and years without having a substantial change of circumstances. The documents I have listed here are the ones that you're going to hear about the most. And like I said earlier, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail into SEPA. You're welcome to ask additional questions of whatever you're interested in. But I just wanted to talk very broadly about what you are likely to run into in the scope of the work that you're doing here. So the SEPA process is going to be completed by WDFW generally before a decision comes to the commission, because you want to have that environmental analysis actually complete so that you all can consider it in your process. That doesn't mean that it can't be reopened and there can't be further work done, because SEPA does allow for revision of the documents. But as a general matter, when something comes to you, you will already have a SEPA document that's been developed. The process that the staff is going to use to do that is they'll start with a SEPA checklist, and it's a document developed by the Department of Ecology that lists different subject areas, and it allows an agency or a permit applicant or someone else who has a proposal that's going to require governmental approval to go through and explain, well, here's what I think is going to happen in terms of the environment related to what I am proposing. And it asks questions about air and water. There's specific questions related to non-project actions. Based on that SEPA checklist, then the department, in our situations that you are going to be looking at, is going to do a threshold determination. And that might be that there's not a significant environmental impact. It might be that, well, with some mitigation, there's not going to be a significant impact to the environment. So we would call that a mitigated determination of non-significance. Or there might be a determination that it is going to have a significant impact. If there's a determination of significance, then you have the potential of having an environmental impact statement. And you don't necessarily go into having an EIS. For example, the department might say, well, actually, we saw that and we're just not going to pursue this any further. Or alternatively, there might be the potential of doing a supplemental EIS or to do an addendum. And those are going to be very fact specific depending on what prior SEPA process has been done in related circumstances in the past. There's one other important point that I really want to make, which is the baseline for SEPA analysis, and that is the existing use. So this is a point that I think sometimes gets lost or confused. For example, let's say you have the expansion of an airport and it's going to add a runway. You don't evaluate comparing no airport to the final proposal. Instead, what the evaluation is going to be the addition of the runway to the airport. And what are the impacts associated with that? And sometimes we'll see that people will come forward with comments and saying, well, generally this activity has environmental impacts. And you say, well, that's not the baseline that we're looking at. The baseline is that this activity is currently occurring and there's going to be a change. And so you look at how that activity is going to change from the existing use. Now, this is a really complicated issue. There's a nuanced version of this issue that's currently being litigated in the Cook aquaculture case. And I believe this Washington Supreme Court is considering whether they're going to take review of it now. So I'm just, noting the complications related to it, but not going to get into those right now. So before I move on to the final slide that I have, other questions related to SEPA. I see Commissioner Smith has her hand up, but maybe that's left over. Okay.
Left over, sorry.
All right. Finally, the Regulatory Fairness Act. And I'm guessing some of you may not have heard of this before, or maybe you all have. It is a small act, but it does have an important role. It doesn't apply to all rulemakings, but it does apply to some. So the purpose is to inform agency decisions about potential costs for small businesses of a proposed rule. So it's sort of analogous to SEPA. Instead of it being environmental, it's related to impacts, economic impacts, and specifically to small businesses. And the idea is that where legal and feasible, an agency will try and reduce the costs to small businesses. There's two key points here. One is, what is a small business? 50 or fewer employees. So there's quite a few small businesses in Washington state that potentially can be impacted. I believe that a number of the folks who engage in the regulated fishing activities would qualify as small businesses. Minor costs has a very technical term definition that involves doing math. I find it helpful to look at the or $100 because that gets you into like a general idea of what the ballpark is. Now, remember that this does not apply to all rules. So there's a potential that there's not a need to do a Regulatory Fairness Act analysis if there are, for example, it's expedited rulemaking or emergency rulemaking. But if it does apply, then the agency needs to prepare what's called a small business economic impact statement. And that will look at what are the minor costs and how those potentially could be reduced. And that needs to happen early on in the process, because that document will actually be issued in conjunction with the proposed rule. And the final point that I want to make about this is not a cost-benefit analysis. Oftentimes you hear people talk about cost-benefit analysis. The APA, the Administrative Procedures Act, does provide for cost-benefit analyses in certain circumstances. That only applies to WDFW in one small area of the regulation, which relates to regulating projects in state waters. So often like the hydraulic projects and such, but a cost benefit analysis is not what is envisioned under the Regulatory Fairness Act.
Amy, Commissioner McIsaac has his hand up.
Yes.
Amy, Mr. Chairman, just real quickly, I don't recall seeing a lot of these, but it seems like a lot of what we do does have an impact on small businesses. So you said emergency rules are exempt. Are most of what we do exempt? Is that why we have not been seeing this as part of a regulatory package?
Well, so for the hunting rules, recreational activity is not going to be regulating small businesses. And I'm glad that you asked that, actually, because some folks will think, well, this could be any type of economic impact, but it's actually direct costs imposed by the rules. So it's not, oh, well, if we have a hunting season, maybe it'll affect businesses because they'll get increased business. That's not a cost imposed by the rule or a benefit related that's direct to the rule. In the commercial context in fishing, there is the potential that some of the rules are going to be related to the Small Business Act. I I think Joe Pinesco has looked more at the details related to whether phishing and other types of regulations are going to be covered. And when you have specific questions, we can address those. For example, the commercial whale watching, they did do the small business EIS, but they actually, it was not entirely clear that it was necessary, because when they looked closely, some of those costs were unknown and were difficult to categorize. And so they essentially viewed them as potentially greater than minor costs. And based on that, they did the small business economic impact statement.
Thank you.
So, I think that I took longer than I intended to, but thank you for the very interesting questions that I think rounded out my presentation. And I will turn this over to Joe Pinesco for the very final wrap up.
Great, thank you. And the last slide is Ethics and Public Service Act. And I'm not gonna spend more than 60 seconds on this other than new appointees for our two new commissioners. There are the governor's website has training materials for all gubernatorially appointed individuals, and that includes materials on the Ethics and Public Service Act. So you're supposed to be looking at those materials directly. And then in my legal memo to the new commissioners, it had a section that also talked about this and pointed to some resources on it. So again, it's just a reminder. Conflicts of interest, use of state resources, maintaining confidentiality of information, and, you know, guard against any potential receipt of gifts, gratuities, and favors in your role as commissioner that could cast a view of impartiality on your decision making. So that is it for all of our slides. It went a little bit longer than I expected, but hopefully new commissioners found it helpful. Hopefully it was a good refresher for some of the other commissioners. Any other questions that folks have before we I'll leave it up to the chair, and if you want to take a short break, but we do, you know, the next thing is our executive session.
Thanks very much, Joe and Lauren and Amy. Really appreciated that.
Oh, I think that was great. Learn more every time. Okay.